Good morning. 4 minutes past the hour. This is the Faith Radio Network. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Bill Meyer. Hope you had a great weekend. Thought we'd start off with a little bit of scripture this morning from 1 Corinthians chapter 13. I love this section. Love is patient. Love is kind. It does not envy. It does not boast. It is not proud. It is not rude. It is not self-seeking. It is not easily angered. It keeps no record of wrongs. Love does not delight in evil, but rejoices with the truth. It always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. That's 1 Corinthians chapter 13, verses 4 through 6. Something for all of us to keep in mind as we start off a brand new week. And speaking of starting off a brand new week, coming up here in just a bit, Rebecca Maxwell, Paul Perreault, and I will update you on some of the big stories from over the weekend and perhaps a few that you missed. Also, what's the latest on the presidential recount? Political science professor Dr. Adam Carrington will fill us in on that story and more later on this hour. Well, you probably heard about the big fire at the warehouse in Oakland, California over the weekend. Just such a terrible tragedy. And it kind of comes close to home because my nephew is one of those guys that DJs at warehouse events, warehouse parties in the Bay Area. And as soon as I heard that story yesterday, I immediately thought, is Michael okay? Contacted his mom, and he is. But unfortunately, 9 people killed, nearly 24 people missing in that terrible, terrible fire in Oakland. And now some sports teams are coming to the aid of those affected. The Oakland Raiders teaming up with Major League Baseball's Oakland A's to aid those people who were injured and the families affected by those killed in the fire. The Raiders have pledged to match up in 30,000 contributions through the YouCaring.com page, which was set up by the A's. Meanwhile, the NBA Golden State Warriors donating $50,000 to help families affected by that fire. The team says the money will go to the Unity Council in Oakland, a nonprofit group that assists members of the communities. Golden State head coach Steve Kerr said before the game on Saturday, "We are with you out there. We're all devastated." And they observed a moment of silence before the game. In case you did miss the story, firefighters responded to the 3-alarm fire at that warehouse in Oakland about 11:30 Friday night. They fought the fire for hours before finally putting it out. Officials say about 50 to 100 people were believed to be inside that 2-story building when the fire broke out. Some people got out, others trapped inside the structure. On Saturday, that 4,000-square-foot structure was just charred to rubble. The building's roof had collapsed into the second floor, and again, they are still searching for missing people there at that warehouse in Oakland. Just such a terrible tragedy. Please be praying for those recovering in the hospital and for the family members of the victims. Welcome back. It's 8 minutes past the hour here at Faith Radio. Love the Christmas music this time of year. Let's see, we are just 20 days away from the big day. It's Bill Meyer with Rebecca Maxwell and Paul Perreault as we kick off your work week. Paul's playing his cello. And by the way, that was very nice. I really enjoyed it.
I thought I was doing more of a viola.
Oh,
there,
I'm
you
sorry.
Know?
It was an air viola.
Those air two viola. Things can be easily confused.
Yes, that's true. Well, bring a string bass in here next time and we'll give it a,
work on that.
Give it a shot. Okay, so we thought we'd update you on a few stories that you might have missed over the weekend or perhaps you need updating on. And Rebecca, Donald Trump he's in a bit of a kerfuffle over China right now.
And he's not even president yet.
No, he's not.
Well, and everyone's been saying, watch out for Twitter. Watch out for Twitter. Whether in kindness with good intentions or malicious sort of glee waiting for what he will tweet, yeah. Twitter has been the focus of kind of what's going to happen, the anticipation. And one story you may have heard a little bit about is that there is now a slight international incident.
A slight crisis.
It's not terrible as far as I know, but it was the focus of much of the news this weekend. Donald Trump made a phone call to the president of Taiwan. And for those who don't know the storied history between Taiwan and China, Taiwan has had their you know, their call for independence for, you know, longer than I've been alive. They were functioning as an independent nation, and now they're with China. So their policy is one China, Taiwan and China, we're united. Taiwan may or may not agree with that at every given moment, but this call that President Trump made to the president-elect Trump made to the president of China was taken very or president of Taiwan, rather. Sorry, I'm an American and it is early in the morning.
China's not happy.
China's not happy about this phone call. And of course, the media jumps on this over the weekend. What did Trump mean by this? Is he going to cause, you know, a problem with relations with China? And Mike Pence has said it was just a phone call, guys. We're not discussing policy, essentially. And now Trump has taken to defending his actions on Twitter, saying there's a lot of things that China never asked our permission for that we haven't been too keen on. Essentially, that's a paraphrase. But so the question now is this an indicator of things to come?
Yikes. You know, when you start doing foreign policy by tweet, you can run into problems.
And a lot of this is probably he may or may not have known. I think that's the question on people's minds.
Right.
Did he know that? Is this an issue of inexperience? Did he think that I can just call everybody kind of on the international roster now and talk to them before I take office? Or was this intentional because Trump has been pretty critical of China basically since day one on his campaign stomp? So I think that's a worthy question to ask.
Well, and one of the things, of course, that Trump has not been happy with is all of the U.S. jobs that have pretty much been shipped over to China, all the major corporations that have, you know, taken their employees or their plants over there. And so that's obviously going to be a sticking point in the months to come. Well, in case you guys have not heard, just I guess in the last hour or so, Donald Trump has announced he has chosen former campaign rival Ben Carson to become Secretary of the Department of Housing and Urban Development. Trump said in his statement he was thrilled to nominate Carson, adding he has a brilliant mind, is passionate about strengthening communities and families. Carson had recently downplayed having any role in the Trump administration, saying he didn't know where he would fit. But in a statement today, the retired pediatric neurosurgeon said he felt he could make a significant contribution, particularly by strengthening communities that are most in need. He said, "We have much work to do in enhancing every aspect of our nation and ensuring that our nation's housing needs are met." So Ben Carson in, he says yes. You know, one of the things we all of us have talked about is that we are very pleased that there are a large number of evangelical Christians surrounding Donald Trump, hopefully speaking truth to him. And Ben Carson is one of those.
Hopefully. One of many voices. And Ben is also one who's, as you mentioned, spoke very strongly about family, life issues, and also does have an interest in the urban sector, the urban area, and seeing redevelopment. He comes from what I think was Detroit. He grew up there, and he grew up in poverty, very difficult background. So he has a heart for that situation, helping people out of poverty. So this is a good move.
Mm. All right, Paul Perreault, can you update us on the pipeline, the North Dakota pipeline, which has just been so controversial in our area of the country? If you don't know, Faith Radio is based in Minneapolis, St. Paul, but we reach out throughout the upper Midwest. In one of the states that we are broadcast in is in North Dakota. And this pipeline and the protesters have been hot in the news and some new developments just in the last 24 hours or so.
Yeah, yesterday, this was kind of a surprise on a Sunday, but the the
Army Corps of Engineers.
There you go. Thank you. I couldn't think of that. But anyway, Jo Ellen Darcy, she's the Army's Assistant Secretary for Civil Works, basically put out a statement, we're not going to grant the easement for the final section. I mean, the pipeline, which extends from North Dakota all the way to Illinois, most of it has been built through Illinois, through Iowa, through North Dakota, South Dakota. It's just the part of the North Dakota segment. I say part, and part of that is to go underneath the Missouri River, what's actually called the Lake Oahe, which is a man-made lake that's part of that. It's not really wide. It just kind of sprawls a little wider than
ancestral
the average
river. Ancestral Indian land.
Well, yeah. Okay, that's the thing. The easement would be just outside of the reservation territory, but, and I was listening to some audio of former tribal council member Phyllis Young with the Indian tribe out there. She was basically saying that the Standing Rock tribe, she was saying that the territory north and around is part of part of a treaty area, ancestral lands, and it's covered under a treaty that was years ago, and that's a big question about that. But getting back to the fact that the easement is not going to be granted, now they're looking at, okay, is there another route? I mean, after all, Dakota Access was looking at a possible crossing about 10 miles north of Bismarck on the Missouri River, and are they going to go back to that or whatever? In other words, this is really slowing things down. This is, again, the final segment. Everything else has been approved, and all of a sudden this last segment, and not a lot of information was given by the Army Corps of Engineers as to why they're saying no. Mm-hmm. And although those opposed to the pipeline are jubilant at this point, they're also saying, well, we know that the Obama administration's out in a month and a half, and Trump could change the game on this whole
thing. Sure, it could happen just overnight. So thank you for that update on that one, Paul. We'll be talking to a congressman from North Dakota later on this week to get an update on his perspective on the pipeline issue, which, of course, has been very, very controversial in that state. 16 past the hour, this is Faith Radio.
Good Monday morning to you. It is 18 past the hour at Faith Radio. I'm Rebecca Maxwell. It is time for Dr. Bill to respond to your email questions about parenting, marriage, and other family issues. Bill can only respond to selected questions on the air, of course, but if he chooses your question, don't worry, he's not going to use your real name. Bill, we heard from a dad we're going to call Steve. He listens to Faith Radio in the Twin Cities on Faith 90.7 FM. Hello, Steve. Glad to have you listening. He writes, "Dear Dr. Bill, long before our kids were born, my wife and I decided we would not teach them about Santa Claus because we think what he represents could replace Jesus as the reason for the season. But we've been getting criticism from our family, friends, and even members of our church who believe we're somehow spoiling our kids' imagination. Recently, a member of our Sunday school class sent around an email that described all the wonderful things that Santa does at Christmas time. I responded to everyone saying we teach our kids about Christ first and that Santa's only an imaginary character. This led to several complaints, and the class leader asked me to keep my opinions to myself. He went on to say that none of the holidays are actually biblically based, so it's okay if Christians want to believe in Santa or not. Please help me with this. I'm frustrated because I feel like my church, the one place that should encourage the truth, is betraying me. What do you think I should do?"
Wow, Steve. Well, first of all, I have to say I appreciate your dedication to biblical truth. But frankly, I think you need to relax. Here's what I would tell your kids in the midst of all this church controversy. Because I've talked to parents about this before who struggle with the whole Santa thing. So here's just a little sample Santa script that you might use when you're talking to your children. To say it's fun to believe in Santa. He's an imaginary character. And, of course, in our family, we know that believing in Jesus has eternal value. And a relationship with him gives our life meaning and purpose. And it guarantees that after we die, we will live forever with him in heaven. But families all over the world have legends and stories about a person like Santa Claus, and young children love to believe in him. Santa represents a lot of things that are good, like kindness and generosity and fun. And it's important for you to understand that Santa isn't a real person, but you can still believe in all of those good qualities. And you might also tell your kids about the real St. Nicholas, who Santa Claus is based on. And if you don't know that story, St. Nicholas was born in Turkey about 200 years after Jesus died. He was a believer in Christ. And as a teenager, he heard about a poor family that couldn't afford to buy food, so he snuck up to their house one night, and he tossed a handful of gold coins through the window. The family was overjoyed when they found the coins the next morning, but they never found out who did it. Nicholas was so thrilled about helping a family in need, this became a regular habit with him. His family was wealthy, so he dedicated his entire life to sharing what he had with others. Later on, Nicholas became a bishop in the village of Myra, and because of his humility, he was given the title of sainthood. From then on, he was known as Saint Nicholas or Saint Nick. Some people say he still comes around once a year giving gifts to those in need. So, Steve, you might explain that to your kids. And as far as your friends from church, you're going to just have to agree to disagree on this one. By the way, there is a wonderful holiday DVD available from Focus on the Family, which you might want to order. It's called Christmas Story Keepers. And after you watch it with your kids, you might even want to donate it to your church's library so they can use it as part of their Sunday school curriculum every Christmas. You can find out about it by going to focusonthefamily.com.
Bill, we have another email for you. This one is from a mom, we'll call Nicole, who listens to Faith Radio on Faith 1200 in Fargo. Nicole writes, "Dear Dr. Bill, our three-year-old son was recently diagnosed with autism. He also has permanent hearing loss and wears hearing aids. My husband and I no longer attend church on a regular basis because of our son's moods and tantrums. The pastor was concerned about our situation, but there are no programs or services that can help us because our church is so small. Certain teachers in the children's ministry have been very helpful, but it's not consistent, and I wonder what we'll do as our son gets older. We often feel isolated and helpless, since no one in the Christian community seems to understand what we're going through on a daily basis. Do you have any suggestions for how our family can find the support we need?"
Nicole, first of all, I'm so sorry for your situation. That is really a struggle. I've often heard from parents with special needs kids who have similar stories. The fact is, unfortunately, many churches are just simply not equipped to offer practical help to families with special needs kids. And from your description, it sounds like your pastor really cares, but again, the church doesn't have the staff or the resources to effectively serve your son. I would suggest that you ask your son's pediatrician and therapist if they might know of a larger church in your area that has a special ministry to families like yours. This might involve a little bit of a drive on Sundays, but it's worth, I believe it, likely worth it to find the support and encouragement you need at this time in your life. Also, by the way, Johnny Erickson Tata's organization, Johnny and Friends, has a referral service that connects families with special needs kids with local churches that have programs like this. You can learn more about that at their website, johnnyandfriends.org. Also, there is a wonderful book I'd recommend to you. It's called A Special Kind of Love for Those Who Have Children with Special Needs. The authors are Susan Osborne and Janet Mitchell. So you might want to get that book. Again, it's called A Special Kind of Love for Those Who Love Children with Special Needs. Thanks so much for writing, Nicole. By the way, if you have a question for me about family issues or Christian living, you can write to me at drbill@myfaithradio.com. By the way, if you have a teenager in your family, here is something you definitely need to know. There is a new study out on alcohol commercials, and it has found a link between watching those ads on TV and underage drinking. A professor at Dartmouth University, Suzanne Tansky, is the lead author of the study. She says that kids that are familiar with alcohol ads on TV are more likely to drink. In clinical psychology, we have a very sophisticated term for this. It's called monkey see, monkey do. Other factors that are correlated with these higher rates of teen drinking include seeing alcohol in movies, having a favorite alcohol ad, having parents who drink at least once a week, and having peers who drink. Dr. Tansky says the alcohol industry has voluntary standards to direct their advertising to audience composed of legal adults who are legal drinking age, but she says their findings show that underage youth still frequently see these ads. Dr. Tansky and her fellow researchers believe the standards for alcohol ads should be more strict, and you know what? I would tend to agree with her. I've seen the stats on underage drinking in America, and they are very troubling. Let me just mention a few. Teens under the age of 21 drink 20% of the alcohol consumed in the U.S. 20% is actually consumed by kids, young people under the age of 21. 36% of kids have their first drink of alcohol by eighth grade. That's right, eighth grade. A third, one out of three kids. And believe it or not, one out of three high school students in America have admitted to binge drinking at least once a month. It's just striking. By the way, for some great advice on talking to your kids about alcohol, you can visit the Partnership for Drug-Free Kids at drugfree.org. 26 past the hour, and this is Faith Radio. This is Faith Radio. You recall your questions when you were a new believer? On the next Connecting Faith, we'll talk with pastor and theologian Alex Early about the basics of the Christian faith and how to work out our salvation as followers of Christ. You can join Neil Stavem for the New Believer's Guide to the Christian Life. What will change, what won't, and why it matters. That's today at 12 noon Central, 1 p.m. Eastern, here on the Faith Radio Network. Now that is some great teaching. Good morning. It's 34 past the hour. This is the Faith Radio Network. All this month, the Faith Radio family joining together with Prison Fellowship's Angel Tree. This incredible effort is providing gifts for kids with a parent in prison. And as we're about to hear, it is so much more. Here is Antonio and Alicia's story.
The most passionate Angel Tree volunteers are those who have themselves been rescued. Do you know what it's like to absolutely hit bottom? Antonio remembers.
When I was incarcerated, my children felt like daddy left them. Daddy didn't care about them. They were left back with their mom struggling because I cared more about drugs than I did about them.
Back home, Alicia wanted and expected nothing from Antonio. This was his fourth time back in prison, and she thought no power on earth could save him.
If you'd have known him 10 years ago, you wouldn't want to be in the same room with him. He was a very scary person. He was very violent and very selfish. And when God broke him, he broke him.
God visited Stateville cell T-235.
God came when I was in prison in Stateville in cell T-235. It's the first time that I met Jesus Christ. As soon as I got a taste of Jesus, that sweet, sweet taste of Jesus, is when I began just trying to serve the Lord. It's not about me at all anymore. It's about Jesus. It's about my wife. It's about my children.
Antonio and Alicia know desperation, but they also know restoration. Their pastor asked them to head up Angel Tree for their church. That first year, they stretched their resources and decided their little church in the middle of a crime-ridden, drug-infested neighborhood could reach out to 10 children.
We asked for 10 children's names, and we got them. And I was just curious at how many more children there were that weren't taken. And I was told that there were 75 other children that were on the list for Angel Tree, and no church had taken them.
We can celebrate 10 children being remembered, but we can't ignore 75 children denied. For Antonio, it was especially troubling. He knows what Angel Tree means to an incarcerated parent.
That's a very big thing in prison, to be able to fill out the application in hopes that some kind person, they're going to give from their heart. And that gift is not coming from them. It's addressed with my name on it. And Angel Tree is a worthy cause.
Will you partner with Alicia and Antonio in this worthy cause? Can you help bring Christmas and the sweet love of Jesus to one or two Angel Tree kids?
Beautiful story. By the way, $99 helps provide 6 kids with a gift, the gospel, and a message of love from their incarcerated parents this Christmas. You can visit angeltree.org to make an unforgettable Christmas gift today.
Every year I'm asked about students' rights when it comes to celebrating Christmas in public schools. It bears repeating. This is Jim Garlow. You'll be told that students are not allowed to sing religious Christmas carols in public schools. The fact is, during school activities like choir or Christmas programs, students can sing religious carols along with secular ones without offending or violating the Constitution. It is true, however, the school districts across the country often prohibit students from exercising these rights based on a false view of the law. I'm grateful to Alliance Defending Freedom for putting together a Christmas and public schools myth fact sheet. Exactly what you need to know going into the holiday season. Know the real facts about celebrating Christmas in your public school. Download this free fact sheet with all 7 myths surrounding Christmas and public schools at jimgarlow.com.
Good morning. 38 past the hour. This is the Faith Radio Network as we get closer and closer to Christmas Day, just 20 days away. Can you believe it? I'm Bill Meyer, joined by political science professor Dr. Adam Carrington from Hillsdale College. Good morning, Adam. How are you?
I'm doing well, Bill. How are you?
Doing well. Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein was able to get her election recount in Wisconsin. She wasn't able to raise the money necessary to get a recount in Pennsylvania. So now her lawyers have taken their fight to a federal court. And I'm curious, you think she's going to prevail in this?
Short answer, no. I mean, even Hillary Clinton's people are saying that this really isn't going to go anywhere, and it's not, and she won't prevail on two levels. One, I seriously doubt that the court will go along with her because of a number of reasons. This is, even by their own lawyers, pretty unprecedented to switch out of the state courts to go to the federal courts and try to make this happen. Second, even if she did so, the vote margin is too large. It wouldn't really change any sort of outcome there. I don't think so in the other states either, but especially Pennsylvania, where the raw vote margin is the largest.
Now, Faith Radio contributor Dr. Kent Kaiser, we talked to him about this last week, and he says this is really much ado about nothing. He said it could be a way for Stein to simply add a bunch of potential donors to the Green Party's mailing list. Do you think that could be part of why she orchestrated this whole thing?
That is, you know, there aren't many signs of bipartisanship these days. That seemed to be one of them among some of the pundits I was seeing, saying that if anything looked like an attempt to raise money for the sake of raising money and get lists that could then go forward and raise more money, this looked like it. And I would agree with the other commentator. I don't see this as anything more than a combination of a publicity ploy and an attempt to do things later with the data and lists of people that you get. It really is, I think, a grafting of a certain kind. If you really were to take them even semi-seriously, that they're supposedly trying to uncover voter fraud that would flip an election result. There's just not evidence there. Even the Democrat, a statewide leader, I think Secretary of State of Pennsylvania, said there was no evidence that any kind of fraud that would call into question the result occurred.
Now, your home state of Michigan just certified their election results last week. What's the latest on the recount effort there?
Well, it's laborious. I think I saw a report it costs $200 per precinct.
Oh, man.
And there are 600 precincts, or 6,000, pardon me, precincts in the state. But in the end, you know, each county board has a lot of control over how they do it. And although, you know, of course, those are all bipartisan, I actually went to accounting of the original final vote here in my county, and you know they have a bipartisan way of doing it. But in the end, while the margin was much closer, I think under 12 or 11,000 votes, I still don't think this is going to move the needle much. Not enough to actually change any sort of the outcome. So again, I mean, I'm all in favor, and all should be, in making sure we get the vote count right, but this isn't going to change the election results, and I'm not sure if the money would really be worth it, to inject my personal opinion.
If it turns out that the election results were indeed valid in the states where a recount does take place, do you think it could silence some of the angry voices on the political left who have been, you know, suspicious that there's been some hacking in these states?
Well, it'll assuage some, but I think in the end, if under these circumstances you are willing to call into question the result of the election in those states, I don't know if any evidence short of getting your desired outcome would actually do it. But I think that at least doing due diligence here will persuade all the persuadables, and I think the rest, you really just have to say, you know, when both sides of when most of both sides are saying that this was basically a fair election, it really comes down to, I think, a larger problem we have in our political culture right now, which is a tendency to believe conspiracy theories more than I think is warranted, and I think that comes from some of the bifurcation of our more than bifurcation, the multiplication of our media outlets, and that, you know, there are people who can sort of find these echo chambers, left and right, but it's, you know, particularly worse for a side that loses. And I think that's what we're seeing here.
And, of course, the fake news we've been seeing out there isn't helping any.
And I know the left has been pushing that, but, have I seen some fake news stories, you know, both sides?
Oh, sure.
I mean, the left is accusing it on the right, but I'm saying, the left itself has perpetuated plenty of fake news over the last few weeks since the election came.
Now, one of the things that's happened as a result of this election is a renewed call for the abolishment of the Electoral College. Do you think that's going to gain any steam? Do you think there is? I know there's been an effort in the past to do that. And what would it take as far as just law, federal law goes? What would have to happen for the Electoral College to go bye-bye?
I'll answer that, if you don't mind, sort of in reverse. What would it take first? And there's two ways you can do it. The one way is to pass a constitutional amendment that would throw it out completely and just say we're going to have a new election system, which I assume would be a popular vote, just a straight-up popular vote. The second way, and this is a way that's already started, and it started years ago, maybe more than a decade ago, I think, is what people don't always know is that states are allowed to allocate their electoral votes however they want. I mean, if you wanted to say we're going to flip a coin, heads Republican, tails Democrat, technically a state could do that. There'd be outrage, or if you wanted to say, you know, whoever Kanye West votes for gets their electoral vote. Technically, you could do that. I mean, you absolutely could. Now, like I said, outrage from the public wouldn't allow it. But what a number of states have done is passed a law saying that if enough of the states join an effort that gets up to 270 electoral votes, then all of those states' electoral votes will not go to who wins that state, but to who wins the national popular vote.
Mm.
Now, and that can be done just by a state passing a law. Now, about 163 electoral votes worth, so about 100 short have passed this. So I don't think we're not very close. And in the end, I don't think that that's going to happen, at least anytime soon, for two reasons. The reason I don't think either will happen is because the states you would need to still flip tend to be smaller Mountain West states, or at least some of them. And there's two reasons they wouldn't want to do so. One is that they don't that they right now disproportionately get power from the Electoral College larger than their population. The number of electoral votes they get compared to, say, California or Texas is not proportional. They get more representation in the Electoral College than they do by a straight popular vote. So that would be them voting to get less power in selecting presidents. Second, most of those states are Republican, and they tend to be pretty happy with the results. So I think you would have to get any kind of strain there, I think you'd have to have the reverse, a Republican win the popular vote and lose the Electoral College. So I think those are all the reasons, both how you could do it and why, because of who won and how. I think there's going to be a lot of yelling, but I don't think the states that need to change are going to move in that direction.
Mm. Dr. Adam Carrington is our guest. He's a political science professor at Hillsdale College in Michigan. We'll take a quick break and be right back here at Faith Radio. Welcome back. 49 past the hour. This is the Faith Radio Network. It's Bill Meyer with Dr. Adam Carrington from Hillsdale College. And Adam, another issue that was in the news over the weekend, we were talking about this earlier this morning, was Donald Trump's decision to have a phone conversation with the president of Taiwan. What are your thoughts on that controversy? You think it's going to spiral out of control given Trump's tweets?
Well, I don't know, given Trump's tweets, the question will just be about what the ongoing relationship with China is, because, since 1979, the United States has had what's called a one-China policy, which sort of officially recognizes there being one China, and that's mainland, but unofficially protecting and having ties with Taiwan as sort of a separate entity. And, you know, I think the Trump hasn't necessarily taken the best, or at least his aides haven't taken necessarily the best reaction to this, because his aides have been saying that this is really a much ado about nothing, that all he did was basically that he would take a congratulatory call from any person wishing to congratulate him for winning. Well, one interesting thing is one of the powers that a president has that is basically no other branch can directly check is the power to receive ambassadors. And that may seem like a small thing, you know, receiving ambassadors from countries, but when there is a dispute about who are sovereign countries, like Taiwan, is Taiwan a sovereign country or part of China, who you accept and who you receive is a big deal. And his willingness to accept this call signals, you know, that he's recognizing in a more official way than past presidents have an independent state for Taiwan. And I think there's advantages and disadvantages. Given China's human rights record, that has a lot to recommend it. Given the antagonism Trump has run on against China, there's things to recommend that to his base. But at the same time, I think that the Trump administration would be more advised to say that this means more than just accepting a call, and instead be arguing about what it means. I don't think that they're without an argument to say that there's some reason to take this kind of phone call.
Now, another controversy related to this swirling around Trump right now is his threat to impose sanctions on U.S. companies that move their operations overseas. And one possible consequence he's mentioned is this 35% tariff on goods those companies produce when they come back into the States. What do you make of that threat?
Well, that threat perfectly aligns with how he ran the election, saying that he was wanting to protect American jobs and punish those who would who would threaten American jobs. I mean, the carrier deal sort of brought this in too from Indiana. That's been a big news item. But what's going to be interesting with that is, I've talked with some of my economic professor colleagues here who are very, very free market, and they just hate the deal. They hate that idea. And I think that what really it shows is a rift within the old traditional Republican coalition and the new voters Trump has brought in. The old voters were very free trade because they were very free market. They wanted government to have a light hand, and they wanted market forces, national and international, to decide things, and they think that that is good for the consumer, that it'll drive down prices, those sorts of competitions. Trump is looking at it from the other side, and his coalition says we want to put America first and American jobs first, and if that means that consumers have to pay more for whatever goods are being shipped in, because that's basically what happens with tariffs. You slap a 35% tariff, typically that means that the price of goods goes up, 35%. And I think this is showing, sort of the rift within that coalition. It's going to be interesting how he tries to bring those together when one side is saying, for the consumer's sake and free market, we want no tariffs, and the other side is saying, for American jobs' sake and American workers' sake, we want something like what Trump's proposing.
If Trump follows through with these threats, is it likely to erode his support among the free market Republicans, those who really have a problem with this?
Yes, and I think it was weaker already. A lot of those, I think, were in the camp of not Hillary, in that sort of vote, but saw him as better. I think the way he'll need to counter that is, and he said he's going to do some of these things, and Carrier said this is one of the reasons that it agreed to keep some of its jobs here, is will he do something to offset that, like cut the corporate tax rate or cut regulations or do something that at least gives that side of his coalition something to cheer and something to think he's furthering from their agenda standpoint.
However, Sarah Palin, who, of course, has been a Trump supporter, called that Carrier deal crony capitalism. what did she say?
Well, that's going to bring – that exposes sort of another subsection of the same rift. I mean, why don't we like crony capitalism? And by that, the broad idea that government will pick winners and losers by giving – special favors to some or special burdens to other companies. Because, I saw someone say that there's something like a dozen or 14 air conditioning companies in Indiana, and this one gets the deal. And again, it exposes the same thing. On one side are going to be people who are saying, we don't like the very idea of government picking winners and losers, or government treating different companies differently, and that that's sort of a free market and equality before the law principle. Others who will say it's not that we dislike that; it's that government's been picking the wrong winners and losers because it hasn't been putting America first and American workers first in who the winners and losers are. And I think that's just another version of that rift within the Trump coalition that's going to have to work itself out.
Mm. Dr. Adam Carrington, as always, we appreciate your insights. Thanks so much for your time this morning, and I pray that you have a wonderful week with your students there at Hillsdale College.
Last week of the semester, so hope so too. Thanks very much.
All right, take care. Welcome back. 58 minutes past the hour. This is the Faith Radio Network. Do you believe that God is ready to use you right now? On the Monday edition of Live the Promise, Bianca Juarez-Olthoff joins the program to help us discover fierce faith, unquenchable passion, and a life-giving God. Then Daniel Henderson will join the program to explain how we can access Christ's wisdom for our greatest needs as we unpack his book, The Prayer God Loves to Answer. That's all coming up with Susie Larson today at 3 p.m. Central, 4 p.m. Eastern Time. Live the Promise on the Faith Radio Network.